So Ruth chapter 2, I've decided on this one I'll actually stick the little things that we'll know where we're at, because people always ask me, and I'm like, because to me it's just one long story. I get caught up, and I'm like, 3, 4, I don't know. So now I'll stick that in there. So, so it was pretty cool last week. I was driving here today on a motorcycle, and I was thinking, how would we... I would have to say, if you try to make an analogy, I don't know, God last week set up the chessboard. He put the board out and put the boundaries and put the squares down. And this week, he's going to put the people, the pieces on the board as he... As you say, he just sets, we'll spend some time. This is just one of the biggest crux in human history, is the few verses we'll read today and how important they are. Because understand that Jesus was, if I was asked you to define truth, how would you define truth? Anyway, got a quick.
Jesus said, I am the way, the truth.
But what does the truth mean? If you gave it a...
You mean like what's the definition of
yeah.
truth? What's right?
I would say, and it's scriptural almost, in the, when the word and the deed become one. So... So when the word and the deed become one, if I tell you I'll be there at 10... And I'm there at 10, I told you the truth. And then you can use, when the Word, Jesus said, I am the Word, and all his deeds, he fulfilled the Word, so he, that's how he could be defined as the truth. So, there's a bunch of prophecy, like many people, we kind of miss that many people throughout history have pre this, post this, have declared themselves the Messiah. You know, it's funny, I was just reading a thing with, what's the guy's name, Soros. He, there's quotes about here, he says, I believe I am a kind of Messiah. So, oh, there's people throughout history that have this, yeah, that have had this Messiah complex, is what I guess psychologists or whoever call it, and, but to prove that he was the rightful, there was a bunch of things, the word had to be fulfilled completely for him to be the truth, to be the true Messiah. And that's where this book plays into that, like, amazingly, when you start to peel it open, the things and the prophecies of the Messiah and stuff. So, with that being said, we'll kind of get into it. So verse 1, now Naomi had a relative of her husband, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. So worthy, and sometimes I get caught in, you can go through, I could do it in the Hebrew Bible, and you, then we'd be picking apart everywhere. But worthy in this case, from what I can understand, like looking it up, it can mean a mighty man of war, a mighty man of law, a mighty man of income. Like, to be worthy is to be worthy of adulation. Like, people looked up to him, and he was worthy of that call.
So mine says a man of great wealth.
So there you go. So he was a man of wealth. There's some say that he could have been a big, like, warrior, like a hero of war. And so he just fulfills all, which is going to play into the story very heavily as we go through. And Boaz means strength. And I looked up, it's really interesting, in 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 21, when Solomon's setting up the temple, he set up the pillar on the south and called its name Jachin, and he set up the pillar on the north and called its name Boaz. So this guy is noted, well, at least his namesake is noted in the temple, and his pillar means strength. He's holding up the temple. So that's, again, I don't know, I guess Ruth posed a very interesting question that I I guess I took for granted. I really don't know how to answer. I wish I kind of did that. You know, do they name the kid and he fulfills what they name him, or does he do something and they give him a name? So I don't know what came first, the chicken or the egg. But usually we just kind of find that their name ends up being important to the storyline. So now we've been introduced to this guy. It's kind of funny because we're introduced to him as a prerequisite for the going into the story. And Ruth, the Moabite, said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So I'll have some bunch of stuff on the next slide, you see. But in one hand, we don't realize how perilous. First off, of reading through the book of Judges, you realize how dangerous the country could be at this time. Let alone, this girl is a foreigner in their country. So this leads to a whole bunch of, this is a lot, there's a lot more danger involved in this than we can see that's being played out here. And then I'll go through the law of the gleaning in a little bit. So here we go. So she set out, verse 3, she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. So happened here, you can look up the word that's used for happened in the I try to use the Jewish Bible sometimes. I forget what the word is, but it means fate, destiny, all those kinds of words. But it's really awesome as this story progresses and becomes more and more important in history. That little word, perhaps, which we would call happened in English, is like one of the cruxes of human history that, and again, you can go back to the book of Esther. I was thinking about, you know, the name Yahweh or God is never mentioned in Esther. But you can tell behind the scenes, his people are about to be destroyed totally. So he's playing a role in it. And right here, you can see that it's divine providence that God is playing behind the scenes. Before you guys got here, I said, so last week we went through chapter 1 and we took it as God setting up the board for the game of chess. And he laid down the board and he put down the boundaries. And now he's putting the pieces on the board for the grand game that he's playing, you know, with his enemies that, you know, they don't even realize they're in at times or don't realize that he has their moves planned out way ahead of whatever they're doing. But this, the fact that she happened, again, just huge fields, no fences. Somebody just puts up rocks, a pile of rocks here, a pile of rocks, and you mark out your property using stones. You don't build a fence. You don't build a wall. The vineyards had walls, but the fields obviously were huge, so they didn't have. So the fact that she happened on a field belonging to Boaz is God's hand playing out in human history. He's just kind of stepping through and moving the pieces where he needs them. So I just think it's just awesome as we go. And then the fact that, again, his name means strength, and he belongs to the clan of Elimelech, which was Naomi's husband, which means God is my king. And as we saw going through the book of Judges, the whole book of Judges says, and there was no king in Israel. And his name, his parents still named him God is my king. Now you can fuss over if he made a good choice to leave and go to Moab, but there's some boots on the ground reality of trying to feed your family. It's not unheard of in the Bible of people leaving where they are and going to somewhere else to get food to feed their families. So all right.
You mean like Egypt?
Yeah. So I'll go on to the next slide real quick because it'll play in from here. So I looked up the meaning of gleaning, and it goes through Leviticus. And just I guess I'll read it just the way they did. Although ancient methods of harvesting were not as efficient as today, yet in Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10, instructs Israelites to make them even less so. First, they were to leave the margins of their grain fields unharvested. The width of this margin appears to be up to the owner to decide. Second, they were not to pick whatever produce fell on the ground. This would apply when the harvester grasped a bundle of stalks and cut them with a sickle, as well as the grapes that fell from a cluster just cut from the vine. Third, they were to harvest their vineyards just once, presumably taking only the ripe grapes, as to leave the later ripening ones for the poor and the immigrants living among them. These two categories of people, the poor and the resident foreigners, were unified by their lack of owning land and thus were dependent on their own manual labor for food. Laws benefiting the poor were common in the ancient Near East, but only through the regulations of Israel extended this treatment to the resident foreigner. This was yet another way that God's people were distinct from the surrounding nations. Other texts specify the widows and the orphans a member of this category. So I have Exodus, if anybody wants to Exodus, Deuteronomy goes through all. We could classify gleaning as an expression of compassion or justice. But according to Leviticus, allowing others to glean on your property is the fruit of holiness. We do it because God says, I am the Lord your God. This highlights the distinction between charity and gleaning. In charity, people voluntarily give to others what they need. This is a good and noble thing to do, but it's not what Leviticus is talking about. Gleaning is the process in which landowners have an obligation to provide poor and marginalized people access to the means of production and to work it themselves. Unlike charity, it does not depend on the generosity of landowners. In this sense, it was much more like a tax than a charitable contribution. Also, unlike charity, it was not given to the poor as a transfer payment. Though gleaning, the poor earned their living the same way as the landowner did, by working their fields and with their own labors, and it was simply a command that everyone had right to access the means of provision provided by God. So we see that God set up a welfare system, and, I mean, obviously in our country, we see what happens when you just give people stuff for free, and nobody has to do anything for it. On the other hand, these people had to work, and we all know, as much as our society poo-poos it, or whatever you want to call it, the fact that you work for a living gives you self-worth. It makes you just feel like, you know, it used to be really disgusting when I was a kid, for the most part, from what I remember, to be what, quote-unquote, a charity kid. You know, people that ended up needing help wanted to get the help and then get away from it to get off of that stigma as fast as they could. And here God's providing people with a means to do that. Spiritually, I would contend with you that in the promised land, this is a form of manna, in the sense that you have to get it yourself. You have to harvest it yourself. God's providing you, even the people that are on the fringes and on the edge of society, he's provided them a means to come in to the fold and to feed and to hear his word and to be nourished by his word. And that's kind of what I got from the gleaning, that, you know, there's a physical, a charitable, a civil part of it, in that it's the law. But there's also a spiritual point in it, giving people self-worth, and it's left them, you know, again, using the man as example, God's provision, and they have to get it for themselves. You can't force feed them. You can't do any of that. They have to get the word, just like the manna, by themselves. Or in some cases, I actually can make the point that people, in this case, can gather it for them if you're very destitute or crippled or something. We see some, and that's why widows were so tough. To being a widow in that time was so tough. If you were older, if you couldn't go out and harvest and glean for yourself, somebody had to do it for you. Somebody had to take care of you. And that's what we're seeing we're going to see play out here.
But the one thing that's really neat in there is God also gives the landowners a decision to make. How much is the margin?
Yep.
I mean, that's how great God is. He knows his people are going to be provided for it. And he's going to let them decide how much he's going to provide. So it takes the law, which he dictates, but he gives them the choice of how much.
And it's kind of, if you know how things probably play out the way they normally do, the guys that left the most margin for people to harvest probably had the best harvest. You know, because God always rewards, you know, providers of charity. So, verse 4, we kind of see something kind of really interesting too. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, which is going to be important. And he said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you. To see this, when we saw, again, this book, I never really put it together, but after we went through the Judges, this book is happening in the time of the Judges. It's a little encapsulation inside this. We were just talking this morning about the book of Judges was written later, and it's kind of written in this descending. You know, by the end of the book, you don't think there's any hope for anybody. And I think that's on purpose, because then you have this little gem to bring you back up. But in reality, this is happening in that time. So there's this little... So to hear a guy say, the Lord be with you, and think about the management versus labor things we go through today. And here they're both... Like, he's like, you know, hopefully the Lord's blessing you. And they're like, yeah, hopefully he's blessing you too. That's great. I mean, it's just a great way to start your day, I would imagine. If you could go to work and say to all the guys, if you had a business, say, you know, the Lord bless you today. And they're like, yeah, you too. So then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of his reapers, whose young woman is this? So obviously, we were talking about that. Some commentators that I went through kind of feel like the Moabites were very attractive women physically. That was why, if you'll remember, when they were going to curse Israel and it just kept not working out, he said, well, take the pretty girls from Moab and put them down on the edge of the camp and entice them into, so you would figure, you know, not to be sexist, that if they were not pretty heifers, then if they went down, you know, went down on the border and they weren't that attractive, it wouldn't have been that much of a, you know, a honey trap. So there's a feeling that they're very physically attractive women. So obviously Boaz knows her. So in verse 6, the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, she is a young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. What's kind of interesting here is, so Boaz, which is, okay, here, I guess this is where I'll break this. There are basically two ways to interpret prophecy. We do, believe it or not, we don't even know it, but we have a Greek method. And if you read all Greek tragedies and all that, they always go to the oracle at Delphi. They go to this and they say, you're going to go into battle and you're going to win, but you're going to die, or this person's going to chase you around the world, or whatever the oracle says. And then when that happens, that's how we view it as a prophecy. It's a foretelling of something that's going to come true. In Israel, there's another, or in the Hebrew culture, it's just they have a pattern that develops. So there's many ways you can say Joseph was a type of Christ, and he's a picture of those things. So here, we're going to develop, you're going to see he's going to develop as the kinsman redeemer. But in this point, he is the Lord of the harvest. And what's really interesting, he has an unnamed servant working for him, which if you look at Genesis 24, there's an unnamed servant who's giving the task of finding Isaac a wife. Later on, we found out his name is Eliezer, which means the comforter, which is even more interesting. So we're kind of developing a typeset here of a Lord of the Harvest, a kinsman redeemer, and he has a servant who's unnamed because his job is to point people to the Lord of the Harvest and the kinsman redeemer. So you'll again placing the pieces on the chessboard to start to move the pieces where they need to go. So she said, so he's telling her what she said to the servant. She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers." So she came and has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. So obviously she's very industrious. And the servant showed her, she's a foreigner, but he has extended her grace in that he's like, okay, come with us. And she's been very industrious with the opportunity she's been given, which just, you know, she didn't just, you know, pick up a little bit and say, I'm good for the day and go home. She stayed at this because, you know, the reality of it, you know, we take it for granted that we can go to a refrigerator and open the door and there's going to be food there anytime we do it. And this,
not at my
and, you know, a lot of these cultures, you're fighting for survival. Your next meal's not guaranteed, you know. So she's being very, very judicious in how she's eating. So then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women." So he obviously has women he considers under his protection, and now he has just taken this Moabite, which we kind of talked about last week. They are a people that God has a pretty harsh word for. It has a pretty specific, you shall not marry them, you shall not this, you shall not. He was very, very tough on the Moabites. Part of it's because of what they did in enticing Israel to sin as they crossed, you know, into the promised land. So it's, so he's brought this, and he calls her my daughter, he's brought her under his protection in his field. "Let your eyes be on the field that you are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." So it's really, on one hand, he's saying, just keep your eyes on this field. Don't, no matter how good things look somewhere else, keep it this. And I think that's kind of interesting when you think about my experience in life has been, like many times I have tried to bring, you know, get people to come to church and you're witnessing to them. And I've had like three or four guys that I've known, as soon as they came to church and got a little interested, they met somebody. You know what? And that person wasn't really interested in church and wasn't really interested. Oh, God, thank you. And, you know, so these guys end up falling away because they're...
Was that it?
Yeah, she's left. she's working for Uber today. Uber Meals.
Bull?
So I Ubered up. What's that?
Who wants to deal with a Red Bull?
I do. Got caffeine. So here, so spiritually, on the physical realm, he's telling her, don't venture off, no matter if it looks like this guy's got a real nice field or whatever, don't venture off. And again, back to the physical world, how dangerous it was in this environment to be a pretty young woman. I assume, you know, you would ultimately be the target. We just saw a whole bunch of, you know, thing of judges where they whacked them over the head and dragged them home. So he's basically saying, stay here with me. And on a spiritual side, the Lord of the Harvest is saying, don't look at other fields. This is where you need to be. You need to be under my protection. So she recognizes at a level what a great, great thing this is for her, and how this important guy is now taking notice of, she's a foreigner. and you know, a widow and destitute, and she would have nothing that would really draw, other than her physical beauty, people to her. But the guy, the head guy, is taking notice of her. So she fell down on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me? I am a foreigner." But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and native land and came to a people that you did not know before." And if you go back, it's kind of interesting. I guess we could go, if you want to, I'll go back. But she made a pledge with seven parts to it, which we kind of know the number seven is complete, that your God will be my God. You know, your people will be my people. I will stay with you till we die. All these things that she pledged. And obviously we read when Naomi and her came back to Bethlehem, they didn't come in as just unnoticed, you know, two travelers coming from another land and just like slipped through them. They caused a whole fervor about the town, which probably leads you to Abimelech, her husband. What a important person he was in the community. And so she obviously didn't come back unnoticed. And now I think it's kind of interesting that, again, going into the spiritual realm, and you start to see the pieces in a different, for lack of a better term, prophetic light, that she falls down and worships him. So now you have this young lady that knows that she's in the presence of a kinsman. Well, she doesn't know the kinsman redeemer part, but she knows he's the Lord of the harvest. So she has started to worship him and, you know, obviously thank him for his provision.
But to get back to your thing, is it a game? The chess piece. He's playing chess with God.
I would say his enemy.
All right.
He's, but
yeah. Look at the benefits that he's looking at from the other point. See, I look at things a little different.
Okay, I'm fine with that.
His opponent, however you want to classify him, he's getting a mobile into this house where Christ is supposed to come from. So if you look at it from that point of view, that the devil is actually looking at all this as a win for him, because you're not supposed to marry a Moabite. You said it yourself. You get all those rules, and it's going exactly against what God has said. The devil takes it for a win.
And, well, do you believe when the devil crucified Jesus Christ, did he believe it was a win?
Yes, I believe he thought
so. Many times throughout history on that chessboard, he goes, check, and God knows, no, that's not. Here, check me.
I agree with that.
So, again, we're seeing all those pieces fit into these little things. And so, it said, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward given to you by the Lord." Again, he's constantly, this is Yahweh. She vowed to, the Moabites versus Chemosh, I believe his name was. I mean, it's kind of like a Baal figure, and, you know, he's a provider of everything and all that. So she's given up all that and say, "I'm going to go with you. Your God will be my God." And I guess we don't really, in our culture, accept how important, like, the gods of that civilization were to that civilization. Obviously, they did human sacrifice and all kinds of stuff, that's how important these gods were. And that's many times in battles and all that kind of stuff, they were looking at it, hey, it's our god Dagon versus your god Chemosh, or however this plays out. And that was a very, very important act. Well, so she's left. So once she cut that string, I would assume she can't go back. That once she's decided that, you know, Chemosh is not her god, that there's a one-way street there. So here, Boaz is saying, hopefully the Lord will repay you and give you a full reward again by Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. I mean, I think that's a really cool you know, he's pictured. How many times in the scripture does God say, I'm going to take you under my wing? But the crucifixion, he was talking about, you know, I'm like a mother hen. I wish I could take you under my wing, but you're not seeing it. And right here, a foreigner is being extended. That's why this book is so cool when we go through how the story plays out and how the pieces fit and how the narrative changes. It has a local level and then a real, real deep level into how it comes. And then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your steward, though I am not one of your servants. So, this is like a picture of grace. Remember the difference between mercy and grace? Mercy is not getting what you deserve. Grace is getting what you don't deserve. So here is a picture of the Lord of the harvest extending grace to a foreigner, to Gentiles. So that is the kind of play out that's going to start, again, chapter 3 is really going to accelerate what we're going to see here in this. So I know that is kind of where we can take our time. And anybody have anything they want to add? It's just me rambling on again. Other than Michael, tell me I'm wrong all the time. Anybody? Judy, I know you have deep thoughts. They're just not about this.
I just got a text this morning from a guy that lives in Florida. I hope you went to church and took communion this morning.
Anybody?
And
Minnie, you can share again what you, if you don't mind. I just thought that was poignant.
So in verse 19, and her mother-in-law said to her, "Where have you gleaned today, and where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you." And the Lord said, "I took notice of you. And you, and you."
I think I cut off one of my. I think I cut off one of my slides. Is it there more?
Yeah.
I think
you're only halfway.
Yeah.
Sorry, I think I cut off one of my slides.
I do that with some verses too, Chris.
Well, Minnie was adding stuff today, so I can cut stuff.
Just called black highlighting.
I'm sorry about that. That's horrible. Three. Get back on. Here we go. I'll have to just read it to you, so I'll fix the slide. So verse 14. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here and have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." So again, this is really an interesting thing. This is a Jewish high-ranking official that's sitting down and asking a Gentile from a very, very troubled people that God has specifically picked out for curses, and he's asking her to share. You can't get any more intimate than that. I mean, think about it with us today, what we like after the COVID thing, people try. But back then, you dipped, you know, everybody kind of dipped in the same glass and you dipped your bread. I mean, you couldn't get any more intimate. Well, that's not true. But you couldn't get any more intimate in public than.
So you're also dealing with Moab, and it could be one of the times where the Moabites are coming.
Yeah, yeah,
so
you don't.
So it's really keeping cold. It's going above and beyond even what God says to do.
And, yeah, it's never. She never seems to be like, I always looked at the people around, seem to be accepting of his judgment and the grace and courtesy that he's extending to her. You never see anybody like, you know, you can go through all the parables where it says, well, you're paying these guys as much as you're paying us, and they've only been here 10 minutes. You know, so you never see people in this speaking out against, like, they know better to talk bad about Boaz, I guess. So when she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her." So basically, if she wanders out beyond the little edge that she was supposed to be left, if she goes into what they're going to harvest, he said, just leave her alone. Don't let her. And to add the spiritual side to it. So now she's been introduced to the edge. She's nibbled on the edges of the word. And now she's given permission to delve into it more deeply and to enter. You know, this is a big relationship. She is now on equal with his workers, with the people that are working for him. So then he says, "Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So now he's making sure she gets plenty, gets fed well, and is provided for greatly. So Ruth gleaned in the field till evening. Then she threshed the barley that she had gathered, and it amounted to an ephah, which is about a bushel basket. So obviously there, you know, they have a stone, and you crush it up, and then you throw it up into the wind, and it takes away all the, you know, the stuff you don't want, and what you're left with is the grain that you're going to use to cook. So again, she had a whole bushel basket. So these people probably started out the day almost dying, her and Naomi, and starving, and now they have a bushel basket of. And you're going to see that she even had some left over from what he fed her that was already prepared when they took a break. So she carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her some of what she had left over after she had eaten enough. And I can't help but picture the five loaves and the fish kind of thing, that here she's being provided. Again, we went from being destitute and knowing and starving to being filled with the word, filled with the grain, and having more than we could ever hope for. That, you know, and now, you know, in a physical sense, I'm sure, you know, Naomi's sitting around all day wondering. She doesn't know if something happened to her, if she's been killed, if she'll ever come back, if, you know, her life is going to, you know, be over, the struggle that she's going to have, no help. And she returns, like, in a better shape than she could have ever imagined. And her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I work with today is Boaz," she said. Naomi said, "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead," she added. This is a contrast, if you'll remember, when she first came back to Bethlehem, she said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because I'm bitter. Because the Lord has turned his eye, you know, turned his hand against me, and now I'm just bitter. There's nothing good in my life." And now this has shown her that God's still working behind the scenes, still loves her, still cares about her, and still has his eyes on her. And so she said, "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead," she added. "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." And other verses, kinsman redeemer. Then Ruth the Moabite said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the woman who worked for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz till to glean until the barley and the wheat harvest were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. I don't know what happened to that slide, but so this is about a three-month period if you go between the barley harvest and then the next grain that is produced as the wheat is the next harvest. So this isn't just like a one-day or one- or two-day thing. She gets to go out every day and work with Boaz's women also, which, again, offers her protection, offers her food, offers her. So this is, you know, on a physical level, this is a really, really great thing in her life that she's gone from being destitute to being taken care of. And spiritually, she's being accepted into the Lord of the harvest, to the people that are harvesting for the Lord of the harvest. So we're going to see that theme continue to play out. Like next week, all the people will be added to the board, and then we'll start moving the pieces. It's a really interesting, it's a really fun book. Anybody have anything, again, anything else?
I have. When she invited her to dip the bread in the vinegar, I looked that up. Vinegar is a type of wine, so you have the bread.
Yeah, and the wine. Yeah. Judy, deep thoughts? First two names in the phone book? You are bitter. Anybody? It is. I just love this. After when we started Judges, I did it because I thought it was relevant to our time, and by the end, you were like, oh, geez, I have to do this again this week. It was just tough. You know, we got to take the good with the bad, but then to go through this is just kind of really, really fun to watch it all play out and the story behind the story. So thank you guys for being here. Thank you. Anybody want to close us in prayer? Anybody? I want to have a good day. I want somebody else. Anybody? No volunteers? I'll just do it. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for everybody here, Lord. And just thank you for your word and just these discomfort in such troubled times. And I find myself just having to shield myself from the world. And it's just so fun to just be able to dig into your word and just have it speak to us and to me, and to be that shelter and that harvest that, as the, you know, as in the book of Judges, as the world's just raging around us, we have this nice little field that we can harvest in, and you've offered us your protection. So just thank you for that, and thank you for this day. In Jesus' name, amen.